Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
250 years ago, George Washington traveled to a state he had never visited and gathered his troops with the odds stacked completely against them. And so began a key chapter to America's fight for independence that very few people remember until today. Why July 4th, 1775 matters. I'm Jenna, and this is Smarter News. On July 4th, we will celebrate the Declaration of Independence signed in July 1776. And next year, we're going to have an epic celebration for the 250th birthday of America. But this year, we mark 250 years since another critical date that is easily forgotten. Let me tell you a little bit of a backstory about how I first learned about this myself. So I follow Mount Vernon on Instagram, Mount Vernon, the historical home of George Washington and his family. And they had a post a few weeks ago citing a letter from George Washington to his wife, Martha, written in June of 1775. And this was really notable because we have only a handful of letters that exist between the two of them. Only three exist. Martha destroyed most of them after President Washington's death. So this is very rare. And this letter was found in her desk. Was it placed there on purpose behind a drawer? Was it there by accident and she just didn't catch it? We don't know. But it's very interesting because it captures a very specific moment in time when George Washington is writing that he's leaving Philadelphia and heading to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he's doing this for a very specific reason. But before we get to that, here's what he wrote. My dearest, as I am within a few minutes of leaving this city, I could not think of departing from it without dropping you a line, especially as I do not know whether it may be in my power to write again till I get to the camp at Boston. I go fully trusting in that providence which has been more bountiful to me than I deserve, and in full confidence of a happy meeting with you sometime in the fall. I have not time to add more, as I am surrounded with company to take leave of me. I retain an unalterable affection for you, which neither time or distance can change. My best love to Jack and Nellie and regard for the rest of the family concludes me with the utmost truth and sincerity, your entire George Washington. So can you imagine him surrounded by people just writing quickly, I want to drop you a line, giving a little update to his wife. Jack, by the way, is his stepson and Nellie is his stepson's wife. So he's trying to give a little bit of an update to the entire family. What he was going to do is take command of what would be the Continental Army, but had previously been a ragtag group of militias from different states who fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill. By the way, they actually fought on a nearby hill called Breed's Hill that nobody remembers. We remember Bunker Hill. And that sort of highlights how history can be a little tricky because we remember some things a little bit different or forget or brush over some of what's important, including this part of the story for America's independence, the immense unknown that this one man faced leaving Philadelphia, going to a place in the country that he's never been before to meet a group of people that he's never met, and that the nation would later be born in part because of his efforts, because of his leadership. So to talk a little bit more about this, about what happened 250 years ago, is George Washington Presidential Library Director Lindsay Chervinsky. She joins us now with why this time in history really matters.
So in July of 1775, at this point, the war had been raging for several months because the war technically started on April 19th, 1775, when the battles of Lexington and Concord occurred. And we sometimes forget that because we celebrate July 4th, 1776 as this huge moment. But in a lot of ways, the Declaration was kind of an afterthought, at least domestically. The Declaration is very much a outward facing, like foreign facing document, because it was designed to appeal to international audiences to get support for their movement for independence, and critically, to assure other kings and queens that they were not trying to topple them, that this was a very specific revolution. It was not spreading anarchy everywhere, and it was justified, which is why you have that list of grievances against King George III. So why that's important is because the cause for independence had been already in place for months and months and months before the Declaration is actually passed. And George Washington is a central part of that story. When Congress gathered in the spring of 1775, they realized that this war was starting. They needed to have a national army, because if it was just the militias of Massachusetts and New Hampshire and some of the other, you know, New England states, then it wasn't a national cause. It was a regional cause, and it would be much less likely to be successful. And so Congress created the Continental Army, and then John Adams ensured the nomination of George Washington, recognizing that it would go better if there was a Southerner, especially one from Virginia, which was the most powerful state at the time, leading that cause. A lot of people in England saw the people from Massachusetts as the rabble-rousers who were causing all the trouble. And so if you had a very powerful Virginian at the head of the army, it debunked that argument.
What I'm hearing from you is that 1776 is like a branding moment. It was our leaders creating a viral moment to announce to the world, this is what's going on and this is why it matters. But in 1775, we're getting organized and we're realizing, oh, this is on. This war is actually happening. And so we need someone that's going to help organize us in a way that can confront this threat that now is very real and is mainly in the Northeast. So this is in June, mid-June, we're in the middle. Isn't there a major battle? The Battle of Bunker Hill, which I didn't realize, Lindsay, isn't the Battle of Bunker Hill. It's a different hill entirely, which took me several decades to learn that.
Yeah, I mean, the branding is so funny around the revolution, because it, sometimes it's a little bit disingenuous. And that's true with the Battle of Bunker Hill very much as well. The Battle of Bunker Hill took place on June 17th, 1775, and this was just a couple of days after Congress had officially created the army. What is today celebrated as Flag Day, June 14th, is actually the birthday of the army. So, but what's important to remember at this time is that news moved very slowly. So even though Congress had done this thing in Philadelphia, news had not yet reached Boston that the Continental Army had been created. And once they had created this army, they then nominated Washington, and Washington prepared to go meet with the army and sort of reorganize it into a national thing. So the letter you're talking about, the one that was eventually found in Martha Washington's writing desk, is the letter he sent her from Philadelphia back to Mount Vernon as he is prepared to march to Massachusetts to meet up with these armed forces, which are now this new thing. And it's an amazing letter because it is very touching. You know, basically, I'm paraphrasing this part. I don't know how long I'm going to be gone for, and I don't know what the results of this action will be, but, quote, neither time nor distance will alter my affection for you. And it is a lovely sentiment.
It is. I love how he also wrote, I wanted to drop you a line. He says something like that in the beginning, which I thought was such a modern expression. But no, he's like, I'm surrounded by other people. I thought I would drop you a line. It sounds like such a normal exchange between two extraordinary people. What was he risking at that time in 1775? Was it treason? Was it death? What was on the table? What were the stakes for George Washington and also the others that were gathering to start defending this idea of America?
Well, thank you so much for that question, because we know how it turned out. And I think therefore we sometimes take for granted the stakes of their actions, but they were committing treason. They were trying to form a new country through war against the British Empire. And had they failed, they likely would have been executed. And certainly Washington, as a symbolic leader, would have probably been executed to make a point, because you had to kind of cut off the head of the snake, if you will, in order to enforce loyalty among all of the other British subjects. And he knew that. He understood very clearly the likelihood of dying in war or dying through capture or dying through defeat. And that is no small thing to risk and to give up. And to be sure, he was not the only one. Those stakes were true for all of the other participants at the congressional level and the military level. The average soldiers may not have necessarily been executed for treason, but if they were captured, the conditions that captured soldiers were held in were truly horrible. This is before, you know, sort of international regulations were passed about prisoner of war treatment. And so the stakes for everyone involved were incredibly high. And they sacrificed and fought for a political legacy that is the inheritance we have received.
Why did they think it was worth it?
Oh, that's such a big question. And it probably depends on the person at the time, because, for example, by the end of the war, 30% of the Continental Army were Black Americans, and some were free, some were formerly enslaved. And so they were fighting for their personal liberty. And I think those motivations are sometimes a little bit easier for us to understand because they are, you know, so stark. For someone like Washington, this decision does not come quickly or lightly. It is a series of steps along the way that cause him to realize that his current situation is that of basically second-class citizenship. The way that the British Empire treated the colonies, it was clear he was never going to have the same opportunity for military advancement. He was never going to have the same economic opportunity because all of the economy was shaped around benefiting London and those in London. And he was certainly not going to have the same political opportunity. And this is where we see the argument, you know, no taxation without representation. At the time, there was no conception about how you would have the colonies represented in Parliament. It was sort of impossible when you have the Atlantic Ocean that has to be crossed. And so he looked around and he realized that he was going to fall farther into debt in the current economic system. He was never going to be able to get ahead in the British military. And his political advancement opportunities were so limited that he eventually felt like there was really no other recourse. But that was a two-decade-long process. And so was not something that happened overnight.
It's interesting as you're describing that, I'm thinking of the word, he's a subject. He's a subject of the king. And that's the difference of living as a subject versus someone with their own independence. But what you're also describing is someone that had some ambition. And I think we associate, at least I do, you know, President Washington with great nobility that was able to take a look at his own ego, and was able to self-calibrate. But also what you're talking about is he's someone that had dreams too, that and that saw maybe the dreams would be edited because of his role under the crown. Is that an accurate way of kind of thinking about him and what, you know, his thinking as going into this?
Absolutely. You know, by the time he was president, he was really happy to be done with power. And when he said, you know, things like, oh, I don't want to be president, I believe he very much meant that. But up until that point, he was a very ambitious man. He wanted, you know, military command. He wanted political power. He ran for office to serve in the Virginia House of Burgesses. He wanted to gain additional wealth. He showed up at the Continental Congress in military uniform just to remind them that he was an option as commander-in-chief. You know, this was not a subtle statement. So he was ambitious. You know, what I think is important is that a lot of the men, both in Congress and then in the officer corps in particular, they cared very deeply about what they called their honor, their personal honor. And it was kind of like, it was more than a reputation, but there was this sense that your honor was everything. It was your political currency, your social currency, your ability to make economic arrangements. And so they were very touchy about this honor. And the British actions in a lot of ways were slights against their reputation and their honor.
I didn't know that about him showing up in full military uniform. That is sending quite a message, you know, dress for the role you want, right?
Just, exactly, you know, show up ready exactly. To play. Yeah. Well, he had a really impressive flair for the theatrical, which I don't say in any way as something to diminish. I think it's actually a really important part of leadership to know when the image and the symbolism is important. And in those moments, he really shows up.
That's and I know from visiting Mount Vernon that he was thoughtful about a lot of things, about his home, about the presentation, about his self-presentation. Such a fascinating person. So, okay, so he's heading up to New England. This is before July 4th, 1775, as we're looking forward to the Independence Day holiday here in the United States. And there's all this unknown. There was this big battle that took place. And it's from the descriptions that I've read, and I'd love your thoughts on this, Lindsay, is this was a group of what would become Americans that were pretty ragtag. They were different militias that were sort of together. And on July 4th, 1775, something really important happens. Early July and then July 4th, 1775 for George Washington. What happens on those days?
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Yes, absolutely. So Washington arrived in Cambridge, Massachusetts on the night of July 2nd. On July 3rd is the first time that he meets with the troops. They do sort of what we would consider today to be like a series of small parades and maneuvers to sort of show him what is available, to basically show the status of the army. And then on July 4th, he issued his second general order. And I love this general order because he's telling all of these, as you said, ragtag militias, and boy, is that how he saw it. I mean, these were men who didn't know how to build proper latrines, so they were contaminating their own drinking water because they had no discipline. And he, you know, described them as dirty and mean. So he's telling these dirty and mean men, you are now the Continental Army. Congress has created this thing, and the purpose of it is to fight for the national cause, and they urge you to set aside your regional differences. So he is talking about creating a national identity and a sort of a national formation a year before independence is actually declared, which is a remarkable thing to do.
And speaks to also the challenges that he was facing. Did we have any idea of how he felt when he arrived and saw this group that he thought, wait a minute, now I'm in charge of these people?
There were a lot of moments of despair, disgust and despair. Initially, you know, Washington didn't really have a good understanding of New England culture. And so he had never been there before. And, you know, one of my favorite facts about this time period that I think is so illuminating is in 1774, when the first Continental Congress gathered in Philadelphia, more delegates had been to London than had been to Philadelphia. And that was because they just didn't see each other as, you know, siblings or friends. They were focused on their relationship to London. And so he had never been to Boston. He didn't really care about Massachusetts culture until he had to. And so initially he did have a lot of disdain for these soldiers, not realizing that they were actually making extraordinary sacrifices too. Because when they left their farms, they didn't have hundreds of enslaved people to continue to work the fields. So their families were risking their crops and their livelihoods by them being gone. Now, he did later develop a real appreciation for the sacrifice of the average soldier, but it took a little while. He also despaired at, as I said, the lack of discipline, the lack of organization. The way that most militia units were organized is they elected their officers, which meant that officers were disinclined to, you know, instill a lot of discipline because they wanted to be liked and reelected. And that doesn't work for an army. So, you know, Washington was thinking about how do you reorganize an officer corps that will instill the proper discipline? And also, how do you get these units to work together when they had different cultural, religious, educational, economic backgrounds and traditions and didn't really want to work with each other?
You mentioned that he gave his second general order on that day of July 4th. What was his first general order?
It was just an organization of, you know, getting ready to be reviewed and to sort of start the process of what it means to have this army. But the second one is the one about sort of the identity and announcing that they are now a thing.
I mean, and so after he assumes this leadership role, what happens next as far as any skirmishes or battles with the British in New England? And how does that set us up as we move towards 1776?
Well, a couple of important things happen. First, Washington goes on sort of a social campaign to win over the elite of New England. He has tea with Abigail Adams, who is initially very smitten with him and writes glowing things to John about this meeting. And so he visits with a lot of the elite families in the area. They then start to think about what the campaign would look like. And, you know, the first several months of Washington being with the troops is really just a reorganization, trying to assess what they have, gather more supplies. Then winter set in. And in the 18th century, winter was typically not a season for campaigning. But Washington thought that it was an opportunity and based largely on Boston's topography at the time. So today, you know, Boston Harbor is filled in a lot of ways, and there's land where there wasn't land at the time. But he had this idea about sending troops into Boston, where most of the British regulars were stationed, and crossing the ice, because the harbor was iced over, on sort of basically ice skates. And thankfully, his officer said, that's a really bad idea. These sitting ducks for British sharpshooters, we should, you know, they're very entrenched in the city of Boston. We are much better in a defensive position. So he came up with this idea of sending his general of artillery, Henry Knox, who was from Boston, to Fort Ticonderoga to bring down cannons that had recently been captured from the British, and basically bulking up the defenses around the city of Boston and putting the British Navy and the British troops in an untenable position. So Knox famously, you know, went up in the middle of the winter and brought down these cannons on sleds. At various points, the sleds fell into streams or ponds, and they had to sort of fish them out. It was really, it's really the stuff of a movie. It's kind of surprising that there hasn't been one made. And they were able to surprise the British by having these cannons installed overnight. And so the British forces woke up and realized they were surrounded by heavy artillery that could really destroy the British Navy and the British positions. They asked for, basically put up the white flag and said, we will leave Boston peacefully and not burn down the city if you let us go. And Washington agreed. And so that is in the early spring of 1776. Actually, Boston still celebrates that day as, I think it's, they call it Patriots Day. It's the day that the British left the city in April of 1776. And Washington decides to move the army to New York City, anticipating that that is where the British will go next.
Which eventually serves to be correct, right? As we start looking at some of the major battles in 1776, how critical was Washington's actions and the actions of his men and women at the time, as you mentioned, there's a lot of different support coming from different areas to America's fight for independence. How critical was this time period?
I think this is quite important early on, because that early victory proves that it's possible. It's sort of, you know, a proof of concept. And it wasn't necessarily a head-to-head battle that Washington won, but being able to force the British from Boston, from a major city, and a really symbolic city, because one of the key turning points in the road to the revolution was called either the Coercive or the Intolerable Acts, depending on who was talking about them. And it basically shut down the port of Boston and tried to close off Massachusetts from the rest of the colonies and the rest of the world. And this was in punishment for the Boston Tea Party. And it was a turning point because many of the colonists in other colonies felt like the king was punishing the entire state for just the actions of a few. And if they could do that to Massachusetts, then they could also do that to Virginia or North Carolina or Pennsylvania. And it caused a lot of the other colonies to actually tighten their connection with Massachusetts in a way that sort of backfired the British intentions. And so to force the British to leave Boston, which had been such a, you know, tinderbox for years at this point, was a big symbolic victory and gave, I think, a lot of Americans cause to believe that there was actually something here.
So interesting to think about what we remember and what we celebrate every year versus what was the reality of the moment. And every time I learn a little bit about American history, I kind of walk away with, how did this even happen? There were so many odds against, you know, Washington and everybody that fought for independence and so many trials. But the thing that I always come back to every year is, even though we celebrate the Declaration of Independence, the war is so long. It was being fought before the Declaration and for so many years after. And I think we sort of lose that. So as you go into the July 4th holiday, as you think back on these different time periods from 1775, 1776, what would you like to share with our audience of your own observations or reflections about this time period, and what would be nice for every American to know about this very consequential part of history?
Well, I think, you know, the way you set that up is so important, because July 4th is this moment that we celebrate. And in fact, when Washington received the Declaration, he had it read to the troops, and they were so inspired that they went and they tore down a statue of King George III in New York City and melted it down to make bullets for the army. So it's an interesting symbolic, again, one of these symbolic gestures. But, you know, the war was, it was so lengthy. There were so many people that lost their lives. There were so many people that lost property and family members. There was so much sacrifice. And in doing, they were able to create something that hadn't been done. There had been republics in history, but they were largely based on a geographic region or a shared identity. They were not based on an idea. And that was a unique thing in American history that hasn't really been done before or done since. And it is also an incredibly hard thing. It is much easier to have a nation that is founded on a religion or a shared ethnicity. It is much harder when it's based on an idea, because people are going to disagree about how to interpret that idea and are going to live that idea in many diverse ways. And they knew that. They understood that this was going to be messy and complicated. It was messy and complicated from the beginning. You know, the founders agreed on almost nothing. They had a lot of different visions of what the nation should be, but they believed it was worth fighting for, and they believed it was worth sacrificing for. And then once they achieved it, they understood how precious it was and were willing to put the future of the nation and then eventually, you know, the Constitution and the Republic ahead of their own personal or political interests when push came to shove, because they had skin in the game. And that inheritance is one that we have to treasure and recognize the fragility of, but also continue to fight for. You know, I think the founding legacy is not one of permanence, it's one of innovation. They were constantly trying to make it just a little bit more of a perfect union. And we should embrace that challenge to try and make it a little bit more perfect with each passing generation, as they intended us to do.
Oh, that's so well said. Thank you for those thoughts, Lindsay. It gives us a lot to think about and reminds us what we have in common, too, with the founders. And for those people, so many, 250 years ago, that we had similarities even then of our struggles, but also was what brought us together behind a common cause. So it's a perfect reflection for this moment in time. I hope this is not the last time we speak, Lindsay. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you. Yes, I hope to speak to you again soon.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Let's be honest. Nobody likes having strangers in their house.
We've heard that 100 times from our clients at Simple Bath & Kitchen.
But then they meet our crew.
And suddenly it's, wait, can you stay for dinner?
We are not kidding. One customer tried to adopt one of our craftsmen.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, we hire people you actually want in your home. Their parents, coaches, neat freaks, your neighbors.
You'll like having us around. Maybe a little too much?
Check us out at simplebathandkitchen.com or give us a call at 614-888-BATH.